I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gail Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. There are just a few weeks left in the 2019 legislative session, and the fate of many key bills that are part of the progressive agenda certainly uncertain at this time. And joining us right now to discuss some of these issues is Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman. Lieutenant Governor, welcome back to the program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here always.
So as you look at the time that's left in this legislative session, can you identify one or two bills? Boy, these are at the very top of the list. You'll be really disappointed if they don't pass.
Well, certainly I think from an economics perspective, minimum wage and paid family leave would have tremendously positive effects for tens of thousands, almost 80, 90,000 Vermonters in the case of raising minimum wage with a concrete path to $15 an hour that's predictable for employers, small business owners like myself. To me, would be probably the hands-down most important bill in my book. But there's a range of important topics. You've got climate change, which is, by all accounts, already affecting our state. We just had flooding again a couple days ago and threats of flooding coming up here in the next couple of days. As a farmer, the impact we've faced the last couple of years with sort of continued wet in the late spring, early summer 2 years ago, and the dry in northern Vermont anyway, and extreme wet in southern Vermont last year through the summer, really affecting a lot of farmers and the ability to produce food in a reliable way. And so climate change, when I look at the vote turnout in 2018, the reality of science with the report of 12 years, which is in some ways an arbitrary date, it's happening. The idea of these dates we set are about how much worse will it be if we don't do anything. What we can do to combine fighting climate change with economic development, whether it's weatherization, which I support the movement forward on putting money into weatherization. I think we could actually put four or five times as much into it, and that would save many Vermonters hundreds, if not thousands of dollars a year on their bills, as well as create many, many jobs. I think investing in real infrastructure for the state around housing to help our employers, investing in broadband to expand job opportunities and bring people to the state, to make the ongoing budget situation better by having better paying jobs and more taxpayers.
You mentioned climate change, weatherization. You've got a bill over in the Senate from the House that increases spending on weatherization by about $4.5 million. It does that by raising a 2-cent tax on home heating oil. Do you support that?
Well, I'll tell you what I support, and it's a much bigger bill than that, and here's how it works. When you look at the Trump tax cut, which I think most Vermonters recognize, and factually it's recognized, vastly helps the most wealthy in the country and the most wealthy in Vermont. If you were to look at the top 10% of Vermont taxpayers, those making $150,000 a year or more, they are receiving a ballpark $300 million annual tax cut in Vermont alone from that tax cut of Trump's. Why not, for the duration of that tax cut, which I think is another handful of years, say, why don't we take half of that and put it into these massive and important investments in Vermont's economy, in Vermont people, in working class individuals who are struggling today, and in investing for our climate future? We could actually have about $150 million a year for the next 4 or 5 years. And in each of those years, put $20 or $30 million into weatherization, creating jobs and saving working class Vermonters money. We could put $20 or $30 million a year into broadband, developing the economic opportunity, particularly for southern Vermont, but throughout the whole state. We could put $30 or $40 million a year into housing. And over these 5 years, you're talking over $100 to $150 million in each of those arenas to truly rebuild the economic foundation of this state, all while still having the wealthiest Vermonters take home half of the money that Trump and his tax cut saved for them. If you believe in Reaganomics and trickle down, let's take that money and put it down on the front first floor of Vermont and invest in those jobs.
You know, Governor Phil Scott is going to be opposed to this effort, and he's going to say by doing that, you're going to start driving more wealthy people out of Vermont and we're going to lose all their revenue.
Well, that's rhetoric we've heard for years, that wealthy folks are moving out. But the numbers actually show that just as many wealthy people move in. And I would argue, since we've heard that argument now for 10 years, 20 years, et cetera, that probably a higher percentage of the wealthy folks and high earners who are living here now are actually multiple bottom line thinkers. They recognize that if we actually invest in our economy for working class people, the overall stability of our state's economic picture will be greatly improved. This would also be a temporary surcharge. It might be 5 years, 6 years. We have to look at how long the Trump tax cuts are, because I think they revert at 8 or 10 years out. And we would say this is a short-term, five-year, significant infrastructure investment in Vermonters. And if those folks feel that's not enough when they're already would be saving that other $150 million, the other half of their tax break from Trump, well, I think there's Vermonters who would happily make that investment.
So from a practical point of view, are you talking about raising some of the tax rates on more wealthy Vermonters?
That's exactly right.
In order
right.
to recover this money?
That's exactly right. And you could come up with complicated ways to say, okay, if those individuals are taking that tax savings and investing it in Vermont businesses and Vermont workers, then maybe they would be exposed to less. There's mechanisms to figure out all kinds of ways that if they're not but if they're just putting it down to Wall Street, how is that tax cut for them, which is supposed to help the economy, actually helping the Vermont economy? I mean, I'm sort of applying government input into Reaganomics to say, okay, if we give rich people more money, how is it going to affect Vermonters and working class people? That's trickle down, which has frankly failed for 40 years because individually the money goes to Wall Street.
Isn't the reality of this situation, though, in the final month of the session, a comprehensive bill like this is not going to pass?
It is not going to pass. But I feel my job as lieutenant governor is to sometimes look at the big picture and set the table for the next year. I've been traveling all over the state with town meetings in Bennington to Bellows Falls, Rutland, St. Albans, Hardwick. And across the board, folks are kind of looking at Montpelier going, what are you doing for us? And there are some good bills moving. I don't want to, you know, knock my colleagues in the House and Senate. There are some ideas like this weatherization bill. There's clearly really good movement on some not just the weatherization, but the recharge stations. There's bills around education and making sure we have a more inclusive education system. But when it comes to economic development, clearly things like minimum wage and paid family leave are critical. But the big infrastructure ideas are not making it. And the public in 2018 came out in overwhelming numbers to produce supermajorities in the House and Senate, I would argue weakening the overall vote for the governor's support and method from the last couple of years. And they want something in return. And if we want that enthusiasm in 2020, which I think will partly be there with the Trump anti-Trump vote, but let's reward voters for coming out and saying, we want real action on climate change. We want real action on housing and affordability. We want real action on minimum wage. This conversation is about setting the table for summer and fall discussions, voters across the state saying to their friends who are in the legislature, what are you doing about these things and why aren't we going farther? That will give support to those legislators to do more, because inherently elected people tend to be a little nervous to go too far unless they hear from their constituents that say, you know, too far is not far enough right now. Folks are really, really struggling economically. You look at opiates, you look at our mental health struggles, you look at some of these issues, they fundamentally come from the culmination of 30, 40 years of economic struggle that's been building and getting harder and harder. And if we don't invest in the infrastructure and affordable housing and weatherizing so people have more money in their pockets, we're going to keep seeing these ongoing costs go up.
Let's talk to Ellen, who's calling from Middlebury. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Hi, Ellen.
Okay. Hi, David. So my question is, according to the most recent Vermont Household Health Insurance Survey, 39% of Vermonters do not have adequate access to health care because of financial barriers, and this causes them to delay or avoid care, which means that they have a lot more serious problems later on. So we have a universal primary care bill, H-129, that would have begun to address this crisis, It would have created an operational plan for primary care as a public good with no out-of-pocket costs, and it has 48 co-sponsors. However, it's received no support from leadership, and I am wondering, why has healthcare, which affects so many Vermonters and all Americans, seemingly disappeared from the discussion of leadership priorities? And what has happened to the vision of Act 48 of healthcare as a universal public good? And by the way, universal primary care would be quite cheap to achieve. It would be, you mentioned, you know, the money that just from the tax cut, the Trump tax cut, that amount, it would be under that amount of money, actually.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ellen. And I know you've been a long and solid advocate for really shifting our healthcare system in our state and, frankly, across the country. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. I am frustrated that a universal primary care plan is not being taken up with more vigor in the House and Senate. We're obviously also struggling with the administrative executive branch not helping with leadership on this as well. And I can't honestly tell you why the political powers are hesitant to go there. Some certainly feel a little bit of pain from the Act 48 experience and us getting to the edge of making that successful transition and Governor Shumlin pulling back at the last minute. I think our Senator, U.S. Senator Sanders, does a great job articulating the reality that if people eliminate – if we eliminate all premiums and do it through a tax system, we would actually save Vermonters tremendous amounts of money. Some Vermonters are paying, you know, $10,000, $20,000 a year in premiums. So the evidence is there that it will work. Sometimes there needs to be, and you are plenty vocal, but others maybe to be more vocal with their friends in the legislature to point out how important this is to give that political backbone to the system to actually pull it off. Because right now, I think generally in some leadership, there's fear of reprisal. And, you know, to me, I look back at 2000 and you had legislators from across the state vote for civil unions who lost their seat. And if you ask any of them in hindsight, do they wish they voted no to stay in the legislature to be able to do some other project? Or are they very proud of that vote, glad for the change that it represented in our state and country, leading to marriage in our state and marriage in this country? I think they're going to bed with their head on the pillow in a very satisfied way with no regrets. And I think it's time for the legislature to pass some of these bold ideas, because what's the point of having supermajorities and forward-thinking folks in office if we're not going to execute and deliver results to Vermonters?
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John, who's calling from South Burlington. Hey, John, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was, or comment, I guess, maybe more was just in regards to talking about income. And I know $150,000 was tossed out. And I just, I guess I think that, you know, given the real living expenses, especially in Chittenden County, that really isn't that much. And, you know, it's quite easy for, you know, two people in a relationship to actually hit that. My wife and I, you know, in that similar boat. And, you know, post this tax cut, we're making investments into our own weatherization. You know, I'm sure that you can imagine at that price, or sorry, at that income level, there isn't a lot of assistance for finances and stuff like that on like cold climate heat pumps. And we just went through weatherizing our house, and that was in the realm of $9,000. And so, I mean, I think it's important to point out that since global warming is a real issue and we need to get off of these fossil fuels, I think that we need to focus on like what those type of people are doing anyways, and realize that you will be taking away from weatherizations that would be happening naturally.
Well, I think that's a fair comment. However, if you take folks in the $150,000 range, their average tax reduction was about $3,000 under the Trump tax cut. So we'd be talking about 1,500 of that. And I know it's, I think, more true in Chittenden County than most of the rest of the state that couples will put together an income that's in that $150,000 range. But the reality around the state is that's only 10% of tax filers. which means for 90% of Vermonters, actually that's not that common and not that easy. The average Vermont income per person is about $30,000 to $35,000 now. And I think I mentioned early that there's a way to also potentially say if you're taking that savings and doing that local investment, like weatherizing your home, that we could say if you can show that on your taxes that you're taking that tax cut and applying it to investing in Vermont, whether it's weatherizing your home or investing in a Vermont business, then we could reduce that number because I think you're absolutely right. If you're using that money to invest in Vermont jobs, which weatherizing your home would do, then that's what we want to see happen. There's a lot of folks who are both in your range and higher up that are not taking that money and putting it right back into Vermont. And that's what I'm talking about accessing.
John, thanks for your phone call. We got into this discussion by my asking you about the weatherization bill that came over from the House, and you outlined this much larger plan, infrastructure plan, to deal with weatherization, other forms of climate change, affordable housing, infrastructure, and said that's going to be an issue, you hope, in the 2020 session.
Right. So
and
for this year, do I support it? Was your question.
Yes.
Fair enough. I would prefer even this year to find a source that is more progressive in nature. The idea that taxing gasoline or heating fuel are going to actually change people's habits has been beginning to be shown to not really change habits in a way that will effectively alter our climate situation. How the money is spent is actually where the massive savings are for environment and carbon dioxide reductions and so forth. So if that's the case, would it be more possible to decouple the revenue source, which politically sounds good because it's connected to your expense, but in fact, decouple those and access resources to make a more economically just society and use the money in a way that creates the climate solutions that we're looking for. So I'm not a huge fan of the fuel tax. If it was the last option, I would support it because ultimately the money is being directed to weatherize low-income homes, mobile homes, the situations that folks are struggling the hardest to make ends meet. It actually will save many of those folks $400-$600 a year. But unfortunately, the number of homes it'll retrofit versus the number – obviously everybody would pay more is still a challenge. But what I find frustrating is in the House, the Republicans argued, look, you all supported a regressive tax. Well, those Republicans all voted against the progressive tax. So we have to make sure that folks are called out on when they're given the opportunity for it not to be regressive, they also voted no. And so it isn't really about what the tax is. It's more about a stubbornness about whether government has a role to play in climate change. And I would argue, apparently, the Republican caucus basically is saying government shouldn't be involved and let's not address climate change. And that is not an acceptable answer in Vermont in 2019. Climate change is a huge issue for Vermonters. It's a huge issue for people all across the globe. And we can create jobs and reduce carbon emissions with, yes, government involvement.
Let's talk about water quality for just a moment. The Senate recently gave its very strong support to a bill that, in a sense, regionalizes the distribution of grant money for water quality projects, but the bill does not include a funding source. How would you like to see that bill funded?
Well, I think that is a real struggle, and I don't have the perfect solution. Historically, when I served on the Agriculture Committee in the Senate, we had an all-in approach where everybody would pay a parcel fee, and in the denser area, there was a minimum of $25 per parcel. But if you're over 25 acres, it was $1 an acre. Now, at the time, dairy prices were a little bit better. We gave a discount on forest land because that's actually a sink and absorbs rain and helps prevent runoff. But I think moving in that direction where we were all in is still the right direction to go. We are all impacted by poor water quality, and we all impact water quality from farms to urban runoff to impervious surfaces. Most people drive cars. That means a lot of impervious surfaces are roofs. So it is not just a rural and farming issue. They're a piece of it, so they should pay. Urban areas, individuals should pay. And you know, we do need to find a permanent funding source. But I'll also say I think we have to be more creative in what we're doing. Back to the large pool of money I was talking about earlier, you know, if we took some chunk of that, $5 or $10 million, and started investing in a program with ecosystem services for farmers, those farms that are increasing carbon in their soil by doing not just the practice of more cover cropping, but doing it in a way that makes sure they're building their organic matter, that actually means less runoff. That means the soil can hold more of those nutrients. Let's start investing upstream rather than downstream where we're throwing sometimes good money after bad. I think there's a lot of good investments out there, but I think we should be reevaluating a little bit and looking at which farms. I actually talked with the agency secretary at the beginning of the year. Are there certain locations that really, no matter what we do to prevent runoff, are going to have runoff? Well, do we offer those farms a buyout and say that land just shouldn't be in farming? Do we offer other farmers resources for moving to an intensive grazing system? Do we invest a couple $100,000 in a study for a Vermont brand of milk that people pay more for from southern New England, and it represents more money going to clean water or farmers' economic stability? Those are questions we have to ask before we truly invest in a massive Vermont brand program. But a couple hundred thousand out of the millions we're spending to figure that out, can we get the money out of the marketplace? We need, I think, more creative ideas as well as the steady funding source to make sure we're not just sort of throwing money down the drain.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Tim, who's calling from Waterville. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how are you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor?
Question.
The governor of the state, Phil Scott, has said that he won't sign the tax and regulate bill as long as it has no saliva testing in there. First of all, do you agree with that idea? And second of all, do you believe that we need a tax and regulate marijuana bill in Vermont? And what is your proposal to have one? I'll take it on the air. Thank you very much, sir.
Well, sure. Thank you, Tim. Yes, I've advocated for changing our cannabis laws for well over 20 years, and I do think we should have a tax and regulate system for a number of reasons. One is that if you have a regulated system, you would actually be pulling it out from the underground market and into the open, where you would have tested product, you would have clean product. As we're seeing with some drugs out there, there's adulterated product that leads to potentially life-ending effects with some of the other drugs that are in the underground market. You'd actually be reducing youth access, certainly not eliminating it, but reducing it, because if 70 or 80% of the underground market moves into stores that you have to be 21 years old to go into, and the price goes down, then there's less incentive for the underground market to continue, which would make it harder for some of the youth to get. Although ultimately, it looks like in other states, youth use pretty much remains steady, whether access goes up or down with a taxed and regulated market versus the underground market. There's really no effect on youth rates. But with respect to the question and the governor, the issue with a saliva test is multifold. One, a study from the state of Michigan, who's also in the process of legalizing cannabis for adult use, shows that actually there's no evidence that the quantity of THC in your saliva is an indicator of whether you're inebriated and able to drive or not, because of how long it stays in your system in a non-psychoactive way, and also how quickly it dissipates from your system in a psychoactive way. So the impact varies individual to individual. And what that study out of Michigan showed was DREs is really the way to go, drug recognition experts as trained law enforcement, to really assess whether you're impaired. It almost doesn't matter what you're impaired on. We don't want impaired drivers, whether it's a legal substance or an illegal substance or exhaustion or any of other way, that you're not a safe driver on the road. That's what we should be addressing. And with respect to the saliva test, I don't support the saliva test as something that a law enforcement officer can do without a warrant on the side of the road, because you actually give up a lot of your personal privacy with a saliva test, which is the difference between that and the alcohol breathalyzer, where you're not giving any of your genetic material with a breathalyzer test. And because the saliva test doesn't give you any information with respect to inebriation in the moment, it's kind of a red herring as a reason to support or not support the bill. Finally, I want to point out that law enforcement actually has the right now to call in for a warrant for a saliva test. So the hurdle that the governor wants is actually not there. And so if we could recognize that if law enforcement has a strong enough reason to get a warrant to take that test and they can do it, then the governor's criteria is met. And I would hope you would consider allowing the law to become law, even maybe without his signature.
So what you're saying is what the governor wants, which is being able to get a saliva test, already exists in law. The difference being that, you know, whether or not law enforcement needs a warrant.
Correct.
Right? Now, there are some people who support saliva tests with no warrant.
Well, there are. I do not support that. The law enforcement has the tools that they need. My understanding is a person was just arrested or charged with driving under the influence, I think in Moortown or somewhere in the valley with respect to cannabis impairment. And that will go through the courts. And that was not with a saliva test. Law enforcement has the ability to pull people over, detain people, do DRE testing on folks for any number of drugs, both legal and illegal. And they don't need an additional tool in this regard. Highway safety studies by the U.S. government show that the level of impairment is not related to the level of nanograms of THC in your blood. If that's the case, then what's the point of a carte blanche test that the law enforcement can use anytime if it's inconclusive? Show me a conclusive test and we can start to talk, especially if it doesn't impede, infringe on one's privacy. But this faux flag of a saliva test that doesn't actually give you the information you need is a huge privacy infringement for what?
So if it comes down to this in the final week of the session, are you waiting or are you willing to put tax and regulate on hold until next year, until this can be sorted out?
Well, I don't actually make that decision as lieutenant governor, so whether I'm willing to or not is a bit moot. But I think, you know, letting this go year after year does a real disservice to cleaner product education for DRE training and added resources on our highways. It does a disservice to resources for honest and accurate youth prevention, particularly talking to youth about the impacts later in their life, as opposed to try this and you're going to die, or try this and you're going to become a heroin addict, both of which are over-the-top rhetoric that is proven not true, which makes youth not believe drug counselors or adults or politicians who say this could harm you. Where it can harm you is that when you try any of these substances in your youth, it does clearly lead to a higher propensity for drug addiction later in life. When I tell young people that and I say, could you wait a few years? I see their brain turning and thinking on that, as opposed to, oh, you're telling me an extreme. It's absolutely not true. As anybody who has kids knows, that's a pretty quick and easy response until you treat young people with respect and have an honest conversation.
You know, the governor also wanted prevention money and education money in the bill. That was almost as important to him as the roadside testing. The Senate bill doesn't include that either.
Well, but the Senate, I believe, in the appropriations bill, if this were to pass, would also put revenue into those programs. So whether it's directly in the bill, or as often happens with most bills, it's in a bill, but it comes out, but it goes into the budget anyway. I think that's, again, political rhetoric versus reality. The reality is if we legalize it, I'm sure the Appropriations Committee will be putting money into highway safety and youth prevention.
So we've got just a little bit of time left. What's your best guess on the outcome of this bill in 2019?
I think it's uphill, but if the majority of Vermonters who support it pick up the phone and call their legislators about this, minimum wage, paid family leave, and talk to their legislators about why this bold agenda for those issues and climate change are important, the legislature has the capacity to get it done.
We'll be tracking many of these issues in the final weeks of the session. Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman, many thanks for being on the program today and outlining your bold proposal to deal with a number of issues in the state of Vermont and sharing that information with us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.